Good morning, Catskills. My name is Scott. My pronouns are he, him.
My name is Owen. My pronouns also are he and him.
And as usual, as we do every other Thursday, we are here to bring you another episode of The Truth Is So Boring.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving. We have, you know, in doing our research for this episode, learned a lot about what we have to be thankful for.
And then some things we could probably do without.
That's for sure.
We were inspired by the settler colonialist nature of the holiday to do something especially brutal today.
No, not especially brutal. I felt it was pretty in line with the upsetting way we do our usually shows, but I'm a very early morning person, so I was getting my start on preparing this show this morning at, you know, 5:15 or so. And I was cutting a clip about the Greensboro massacre in 1979, and I was like, I'm just imagining myself, like, you know, preparing, you know, brunch for the holiday and you know, hearing that, and just be like, I was like, yeah, it's not a good day for that. So maybe another time. I decided that, especially given that it's a feast holiday, that perhaps it would be pleasant to discuss the obesity epidemic,
quote-unquote.
Yeah, and some interesting...
The people weigh more now, and somehow we're concerned about an epidemic.
And I just want to say that, like, I am 6'3" and 250 pounds, which gives me a BMI of, like, just over 30, so technically obese. I've been a lot more obese than that, and I've been as little as 170 during the last 5 years that I've known you, Owen.
Meanwhile, I'm 5'2", and I'm struggling to achieve over 110 pounds, which puts my BMI at 19, which is underweight.
And I just
wanted to struggle my whole life.
I just wanted to say that, like, you know, on a personal note, during the 5 or 6 years that we've known each other, you know, I've gone from 170 pounds to 300 and to 250 and you know, trying to learn to understand why all those changes happened to me, as you know, as my life changed. And also, like, you know, thinking about this morning about, like, how you've stayed exactly the same size the whole time I've known you, and we've been eating the same things and doing most of the same stuff.
Well, okay, so my eating habits vary wildly depending on my mental health and my physical condition, and yeah, my weight really doesn't fluctuate. The lowest it ever was when I was at my worst depression and just unable to eat properly, and also not medicated, I was like in the 98s, which is bad, which is really bad. Don't do that to yourself ever, especially don't do it on purpose. But, like, I struggle to get anything over 110, even after testosterone, which is probably the single greatest factor that has gotten my weight into a relatively healthy-ish range. And this whole thing is really funny to me, because when I was a preteen, I was chubby. I don't know if I've ever shown you any pictures of me, but
I've seen him around. I wouldn't classify you as terribly chubby.
I wasn't terribly chubby. I mean, like, people around me would still call me a stick. One of my best friend's mom was like, just like, you need to put some weight on you. And meanwhile, she was telling her kid that she needed to lose weight. So anyway, before I go off anymore, let's get into the meat. Maybe.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with genetics, but yeah,
it does.
Let's get into a lot of those factors in this episode and probably the next. But first, you had the couple quick tweets you saw this morning that you wanted to share because you thought they were entertaining.
This is a joke format we like to call on Twitter "Shot and Chaser." All right, so first we got something
like
serious,
like the drink thing.
Yes, yeah. Like the drink thing.
Something harsh and then something to laugh it off with that on the same topic.
Yeah, so here's the bad news, and then we'll follow with the good news. It's not news. It's just observations. So this is from Ugopnik, I think that's the name. The greatest trick ever pulled on the working class was making them think that they're the consumer class. No longer workers, but clients. No longer laborers, but shoppers. We are to bear humiliation at work and export said humiliation on others as clients.
I thought that last part was really, really nice whenever you said it. The chasers from at Flag Raider. Do you want to go ahead?
No, you.
Okay. Very funny that people used to answer to higher minimum wage demands by saying they just automate the jobs. And now that it's prime time to do it due to labor shortage, the tech doesn't work and it's too expensive. So they just put up signs saying, sorry, we can't McDonald's today. And yeah, I mean, that's it.
On the nose.
That's kind of what we in the tech industry have kind of always known is, like, Yeah, automation only goes so far. Automation can make your job easier, it can make you more efficient at it, but at the end of the day, you still got to have somebody doing it.
Yeah, the classic, oh, but who's going to fix the machine that fixes the machine that fixes the machine? Like,
yeah.
There's got to be a guy at the end of the line somewhere. Like, it's not... We haven't invented the self-replicating paperclip factory yet, and God help us if we ever do.
Yeah, good point. I wanted to make a quick commentary on Black Friday. I saw in discussion earlier just something brought to mind and I thought was interesting. Black Friday was originally invented as the day that retail companies would turn a profit, 11 months of revenue dedicated to reinvesting in the company and ensuring the livelihood of their employees or members. In the quarter ending in October 31st, 2021, so just the quarter, they made profit each quarter during the year. Walmart made $35.5 billion in profit.
In 3 months.
A 3.3% increase year over year. Walmart annual gross profit for 2021 was $138.8 billion, with a 7.3%, which is a 7.33% increase from 2020. But Walmart isn't an outlier. This sort of insane disparity between the way our society treats the people who keep the country going, like the workers at the retail stores, and their owners is everywhere. I think that's all on that. You have a interstitial?
Yes. Owen here. I got to pick the interstitials today, and I'm very pleased to announce that they will all be Ween songs. This is Frank from one of my favorite albums, The Pod. Please enjoy.
This is what I get for letting you pick the interstitials. Let's get started with the main topic for today. This comes from the Slime Mold Time Mold blog at slimemoldtimemold.com. We will have links, of course, to everything that we share with you today at our website.
Always a fun name.
At thetruthissoboring.org. Yeah, Slime Mold Time Mold is a fun name. It's always fun to recommend it to people because it's like, oh, you haven't read this thing yet. Go to Slime Mold Time Mold. And they're like, wait, what?
Yeah, hey, man, have you read the new Slime Mold Time Mold? What are you talking about, bro?
Anyway, the series of articles that we're talking about today is called A Chemical Hunger. And we're going to start off today with part one, Mysteries. And we'll probably get to part two as well.
There are 10 parts. I wasn't expecting to finish them
and
today.
And several interludes in between,
yeah.
Too. It's
highly detailed.
I was reading the summary article today, because I haven't finished reading the whole thing. I've only read a few of the articles yet. It's very long, and the author was saying that they felt that it was like a book-length thing.
Totally. This person should be getting money for this. They put so much effort into this.
I hope they will.
I hope donations
I think they have a Patreon, actually.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you find this compelling, then, you know, so donate to them.
You can check out their
and
work.
Also the
and
station.
Make your own decision. I can't tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Nor do I want to.
Well, I'm just saying, maybe donate to the station if you're going to consider donating them, too.
Well, it's easy enough to do it at wioxradio.org,
yeah.
Which you might be listening in from anywhere in the world, or perhaps you're just watching on MTC Cable Channel 20, or just listening in on 91.3 FM, as we are used to saying, or 107.5 FM, hello SUNY Delhi. And again, that is wioxradio.org, if you want to listen in on the internet.
Regardless.
And that's where you can find our donation links, if you like what you hear and feel like donating.
Sorry for interrupting. Regardless, Catskills, turn it up, tune in, and listen to this. I know it blew my mind.
And it blew my mind.
Go on, Owen. Let's start reading.
Mystery 1, the obesity epidemic. The first mystery is the obesity epidemic itself. It's hard for a modern person to appreciate just how thin we all were for most of human history. A century ago, the average man in the United States weighed about 155 pounds. Today he weighs about 195 pounds. About 1% of the population was obese back then. Now, it's 36%. Obese by, you know, medical definition of obesity, which is based on BMI calculations and such. I'm sure you're all familiar with it if you've been to a physical
and actually been weighed. I know you haven't read the conclusions yet, but the disparity between the disparity between BMI as a measurement for fat levels and BMI being a poor measurement actually comes into play as like a recommendation for yourself. Although there are very few recommendations that individuals can take, I will warn you for that throughout this.
Obesity is, spoiler alert, individualizing a systemic issue, which is really what we should be calling our show, honestly. Because
at this point, yeah, that's kind of what it's become. Anyway, back in the 1890s, the federal government had a board of surgeons examine several thousand Union Army veterans who fought in the Civil War.
A board of surgeons, that is.
That's not what I said?
You kind of mumbled over it, sorry.
Okay. This was several decades after the end of the war, so by this point, veterans were all in their 40s or older. This gives us a snapshot of what middle-aged white men looked like in the 1890s. When we look at their data, we find that they had an average BMI of about 23, overweight is 25, and obese is 30 or more. Only about 3% of them were obese. In comparison, middle-aged white men in the year 2000 had an average BMI of around 28. About 24% were obese in their early middle age, increasing by 41% or to 41% by the time the men were in their 60s. Most experts consider measures like body fat percentage to be better measures of adiposity than BMI, and we agree. Unfortunately, nearly every source reports that BMI and most don't report. Nearly every source reports BMI, and most don't report body fat percentage. Here, we use BMI so that we can compare different sources to one another.
It's not just that we're a little fatter than our great-grandparents. The entire picture is different. And here's an ad. I kind of wish I had prepared slides now, because this ad is great, but you can check it out on Simon Timewald's article. It's a woman, and she's kind of curvy, but certainly not in the range of like what we would necessarily consider like obese or overweight or whatever.
She's thinner than I am. That's for sure.
Yeah, she's got like my figure, I guess.
I don't know.
She's actually a bit wider than me. Yeah. Anyway, it says men wouldn't look at me when I was skinny, which it gives you an interesting picture.
She says, but I gained 10 pounds this new easy way, and I have all the dates I want.
And I think if you'll recall from your history lessons and arts and stuff that you've seen of Renaissance paintings of extremely fat people, like, being overweight used to be a sign of wealth and health and such. People in the 1800s did have diets, reading again from the article, that were very different from ours. But by conventional wisdom, their diets were worse, not better. They ate more bread and almost four times more butter than we do today. They also consumed more cream, milk, and lard. This seems closely related to observations like the French paradox. The French eat a lot of fatty cheese and butter, so why aren't they fatter and sicker?
Yeah, why aren't you fatter?
I know, right? I eat tons of my family loves to torture me with the butter story. When I was like a baby, I like grabbed a stick of butter and just started nomming on it.
Oh, no.
Just a stick of butter.
That's terrible.
And now they all like make fun of me forever for it. But I mean, like you know, it went to my face and nowhere else.
Yeah, don't gross out the listeners. our great grandparents and the French were able to maintain these weights effortlessly. They weren't all on weird starvation diets or crazy fasting routines. And while they probably exercised more on average than we do, the minor difference in exercise isn't enough to explain the enormous difference in weight. Many of them were farmers and laborers, of course, but plenty of people in 1900 had cushy desk jobs, and those people weren't obese either.
Yeah, if you recall, bureaucracy was invented like 6,000 years ago by the Chinese. Cushy desk jobs have been around forever. Humans have been doing them forever. Just because we do them more now doesn't mean we didn't used to do them.
Right. Mystery number two.
An abrupt shift. Another thing that many people are not aware of is just how abrupt this change was. Between 1890 and 1976, people got a little heavier. The average BMI went from about 23 to 26. This corresponds with rates of obesity going from about 3% to about 10%. The rate of obesity in most developed countries was steady around 10% until 1980, when it suddenly began to rise.
I wonder what changed in the 1980s. There's a graph here. Trends in adult overweight obesity and extreme obesity in men and women aged 20 through 74, United States, 1960 through 1962, or 1960 to 1962 through 2013 to 2014. And there is a marked trend in increase starting at around 1976 to 1980, especially in obesity among men, overweight among men, and extreme obesity among women. Some other stuff like that seems to have stayed largely the same, but obesity, specifically like the not too extreme in either direction, has increased, you know, pretty markedly since 1960, 1980, with some interesting variations, which I'm guessing are probably due to more frequent testing starting off at the in the early 2000s.
Today, the rate of obesity in Italy, France, and Sweden is about 20%. In 1975, there was no country in the world that had an obesity rate higher than 15%. Let me repeat that. In 1975, there was no country in the world that had an obesity rate higher than 15%. And now it is, what, 36% in America?
I don't know off the top of my head.
We read it off like a minute ago. Hang on.
I'll go on while you're looking.
Yes, it's 36%.
Wow, that's very high. This wasn't a steady decline, this wasn't a steady gentle trend as food got better or diets got worse. People had access to plenty of delicious, high-calorie foods back in 1965. Doritos were invented in 66, Twinkies in 1930, Oreos 1912, and Coca-Cola all the way back in 1886. So what changed in 1980?
Common wisdom today tells us that we got heavier as we got older, but historically this wasn't true. In the past, most people got slightly leaner as they got older. Those Civil War vets we mentioned above had an average BMI of 23.2 in their 40s and 22.9 in their 60s. In their 40s, 3.7% were obese compared to 2.9% in their 60s. We see the same pattern in data from 76 to 1980. People in their 60s had slightly lower BMIs and were slightly less likely to be obese than people in their 40s. See table below, which again you can access on SimulTimeld or in our notes.
And so again, that's mystery number two, which is the fact that the shift was abrupt and...
wasn't until about the 1980s that we start to see this trend reverse. Something fundamental about the nature of obesity has changed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you not finish? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just felt like it would be a good bookend.
Yeah. So, abrupt change. Mystery number three, the ongoing crisis. Things don't seem to be getting any better. A couple decades ago, rising obesity rates were a frequent topic of discussion, debate, and concern. But recently, it has received much less attention. From the lack of press and popular coverage, you might reasonably assume that if we aren't winning the fight against obesity, we've at least gotten to a stalemate. But this simply isn't the case. Americans have actually gotten more obese over the last decade. In fact, obesity increased more than twice as much between 2010 and 2018 than it did between 2000 and 2008.
Rates of obesity are also increasing worldwide. As The Lancet notes, unlike other major causes of preventable death and disability, such as tobacco use, injuries, and infectious diseases, there are no exemplar populations in which the obesity epidemic has been reversed by public health measures. There are no exemplar populations in which the obesity epidemic has been reversed by public health measures.
Mm-hmm.
Very mysterious. Do we want to do an interstitial now? Or?
It is mysterious, but it also, like, once you hear it, you're like, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Go ahead with an interstitial.
Like a mega wish inside. on the strain. Everything remains, but we must further ourselves on.
All right, that's enough of that.
Oh, never enough ween.
Yeah, of course. Now, things get weird.
Pork roll, egg, and cheese by Ween.
Oh, that's why you wanted to take the break longer. You wanted to hear more of the song.
Uh-huh. Mystery number four. Okay, we're getting into the weird ones now. Those are just, like, the just general surface level, like, okay, so there's something going on here, but nothing that seems, like,
here's
particularly
where it gets fun.
Spooky. Yeah, this is just outright, like, gonna start throwing all your assumptions out the window, turning everything we know about public health on its head. So strap in, buckaroo, or whatever they say on Tumblr.
A common assumption is that humans evolved eating a widely varied diet of wild plants and animals, and that our bodies still crave variety, and that we would be better off with a more varied diet. But when we look at hunter-gatherers, we see this isn't true.
Modern hunter-gatherers that exist today.
Yes. The Kunsang of Tanzania...
You're missing the part.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's the click or...
Kung.
I don't know what kind of click it is. It could be another click. It's just a... It's an exclamation mark.
The exclamation mark is the click that is in the back of your throat, I'm pretty sure.
Oh. I'm just going to say Kunsang.
Okay, fine.
I don't want to make it awkward by trying too hard.
Okay, that's fair.
They get about 40% of their calories from a single food source. It's called the Mungongo nut, with another 40% coming from meat.
And it's not a special nut. It's just a nut, you know? Like, you could replace that with an almond or something. It's a nut. It's nothing like... It's not like... We're not saying, oh, they live on a superfood. No.
Yeah. But they... Yeah, we're
it's
not saying...
It's just tree food. Normal tree food.
Well, like, that's exactly, like, what we're going to get to is, like, if you switch your diet to eating 40% Mungongo nut and 40% meat and change nothing else about your life, that's not going to, about your situation that you're in, about
that's your, not going
your
to
material
make
you conditions, it's not going to suddenly make you lose a bunch of weight.
You probably will put on more weight if you do that. But if you do that and you live near, like, a pollution source. But we'll get into it more in a minute.
The Kunsang are extremely lean, about 110 pounds on average, and have excellent cardiovascular health.
Oh, like me.
Of course, variety isn't everything. You would also expect that people need to eat the right diet, a balanced diet, with the right mix of macronutrients. But again, this doesn't seem to be the case.
Nope.
Hunter-gatherer societies around the world have incredibly different diets, some of them very extreme, and almost never suffer from obesity.
Historically, different cultures had wildly different diets. Makes sense, there's different things that grow in different climates. Some hunter-gatherers ate diets very high in sugar, like higher than ours, we'll get into that in a sec. Some very high in fat, some very high in starch, etc. Some had diets that were extremely varied, while others survived largely off just two or three foods. Yet all these different groups remained lean. This is strong evidence against the idea that a high-fat, high-sugar, high-starch, low-variety, high-variety, etc. diet could cause obesity. I was going to keep going if that's
okay,
cool.
Okay, go ahead.
A Tanzanian hunter-gatherer society called the Hadza get about 15% of their calories from honey. That's a lot.
That's a lot of honey.
That's eating honey every single day. That's more honey than I would get sick off of that just from the taste. Combined with all the sugar they get from eating fruit, they end up eating about the same amount of sugar as Americans do. Despite this, the Hadza do not exhibit obesity. Another group, the Mbuti of the Congo, eat almost nothing but honey during the rainy season when honey can provide up to 80% of the calories in their diet.
Oh my goodness. That's literally just eating spoonfuls of honey.
Every day, yeah.
Wow.
Like, most of your meal is honey.
These are all unrefined sugars, of course, but the Kuna of Panama, though mostly hunter-gatherers, also obtain white sugar and some sugar-containing foods from trade. Their diet is 65% carbohydrates and 17% sugar, which is more sugar than the average American currently consumes. Despite this, the Kuna are lean, with average BMIs around 22 to 23.
I just want to repeat that. The Kuna eat more sugar than Americans do, but... They have way less obesity.
Yeah.
So
and they're not even overweight. 22 to 23 is below overweight.
Yeah, that's just normal range. The Inuit, by contrast, traditionally ate a diet consisting primarily of seal meat and blubber, with approximately 50% of their calories coming from fat. This diet is quite low in fruits and vegetables, but obesity was virtually unknown until the arrival of Western culture. The Maasai are an even... Yeah, right? Big there. The Maasai are an even more extreme example, subsisting on a diet composed almost exclusively of milk, blood, and meat.
Oh yeah, this is a fun one.
They drink an average of, like, this is for all you meatitarians out there in America. This is a little vindication, you could say. The Maasai drink an average of 3 to 5 quarts a day of their staple, milk supplemented with cow's blood and meat.
I'm just picturing Jordan Peterson groaning.
Okay. Did you hear about that family in the news that was like, milk is too expensive because we drink like gallons of it?
No.
Oh, well, this is just making me think of them because everyone was like making fun of them because like humans are supposed to be lactose intolerant at once they reach adulthood, but some white people like me still have this gene for eating the lactose, so people like us just get away with eating tons of milk. Anyway. The Maasai drink an average of 3 to 5 quarts a day of milk supplemented with cow's blood and meat. This adds up to about 3,000 calories a day, 66% of which are from fat. They also sometimes eat honey and tree bark. But the Maasai are also quite lean, with the average BMI for both men and women being, again, in the range of 22 to 23, increasing very slightly over age.
So, the one time that I did actually gain a lot of weight from a, specifically from a poor diet, I was eating around 3,000 calories a day, and I'm just, like, the idea of, like, living like that and not getting really fat is just... How does that happen?
But it's just, you know.
And also, like, the idea that what they're consuming is 3 to 5 quarts a day of milk and cow's blood and meat.
I mean, yeah, it sounds disgusting to us because we don't live like that. But, I mean, they do just fine. They're perfectly healthy and not overweight.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Catawba is my real favorite because we'll get into how much exercise they do.
There's a lot about them.
Oh, there's a lot more detail about them. But, like, so far we haven't really heard about, like, how much exercise, like, how many calories these people burn per day.
Mm-hmm.
But the Catawbans are really interesting because they are very sedentary. They're, like, almost as sedentary or as sedentary as Americans.
Well, let's get into that when we get to it.
Yes. Catawba is a Melanesian island, largely isolated from the outside world. In 1990, Staffan Lindenberg went to the island to study the diet, lifestyle, and health of its people.
Lindenberg,
my bad. He found a diet based on starchy tubers and roots, like yam, sweet potato, and taro, supplemented by fruit, vegetables, seafood, and coconut. Food was abundant and easy to come by, and the Catawbans ate as much as they wanted. It is obvious from our investigations, wrote Lindenberg, that lack of food is an unknown concept, and the surplus of fruits and vegetables regularly rots or is eaten by dogs. About 70% of the calories in the Catawban diet come from carbohydrates. For comparison, the modern American diet is about 50% carbs. Despite this, none of the Catawbans are obese. Instead, they were in excellent health. Below, you'll see a photo of a Catawban man being examined by Lindenberg. He looks ripped, honestly.
He does. He looks kind of ripped. It's impressive.
Catawbans don't even seem to gain weight in middle age. In fact, BMI was found to decrease with age. Many lived into their 80s or 90s, and Lindenberg even observed one man who he estimated to be about 100 years old. None of the elderly Catawbans showed signs of dementia or memory loss. The Catawbans also had no incidence of diabetes, heart attack, stroke, or cardiovascular disease, and they were unfamiliar with the symptoms of these diseases. The only cases of sudden death that they could recall, he reports, were accidents such as drowning or falling from a coconut tree.
So, these people have a lifestyle where they aren't really compelled to spend a ton of time exercising, and they have as much food as they want, and it's generally pretty carbohydrate, you know, pretty similar diet, and yet they have no incidences of diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, or cardiovascular disease.
They eat more carbs than we do.
No incidence?
Yeah, they virtually unknown are the words that I'm reading off this page.
Mystery number 5, lab animals and wild animals.
It gets weirder from here, so strap in. Humans, okay, go on, you can do
Humans aren't the only ones growing more obese. Lab animals and even wild animals are becoming more obese as well. Primates and rodents living in research colonies, feral rodents living in our cities, and domestic pets like dogs and cats are all steadily getting fatter and fatter.
We're not talking about the primordial pouch on your cat. We're talking about actual fat.
Well, I mean, you see a chonker cat and you know what they look like.
No. Okay, you see a chonker cat, half the time you're looking at primordial pouch, which is just a flap of skin with a bunch of fuzz on it. No fat.
Anyway.
Sorry.
This can't be attributed to changes in what they eat because lab animals live in contained environments with highly controlled diets. They are being fed the same foods as always, but for some reason, they're getting fatter.
They eat really highly, like, lab food hasn't changed in the past 100 years, and they're getting fatter. Like, the lab regimen that they feed them on hasn't changed.
This seems to be true everywhere you look. Our pets may eat scraps from the table, but why would zoo animals, being fed by professionals, also be getting fatter? Even horses are becoming more obese. This is all very strange, and none of it fits with the normal explanations of the obesity epidemic.
Mystery number 6, palatable human food.
This one doesn't seem that mysterious to me, honestly.
Yeah, but...
I mean, it's really, like...
It was surprising the first time.
Yeah, it's surprising, but, like, it's also kind of like, well, yeah, now that you think about it, it kind of does seem like that. Bet you can't eat just one.
Lab rats gain some weight on high-fat diets, but they gain much more weight on a cafeteria diet of human foods like Fruit Loops and salami. It used to be that if researchers needed obese rats for a study, they would just add fat to normal rodent chow, which, again, rodent chow hasn't changed in decades.
It's regulated to make, you know, to make it controlled so that you can experiment on them and not, like, have what they're eating come into play in you know,
yeah.
the experiment.
So you can, like, make predictions because you know what the inputs are.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the input hasn't changed and yet the output is changing is, like, very mm-hmm. concerning, to say the least. It
turns out that it takes a long time for rats to become obese on this diet.
Just adding fat to rodent chow.
Mm-hmm.
A breakthrough occurred one day when a graduate student happened to put a rat onto a bench where another student had left a half-finished bowl of Fruit Loops. Rats are usually cautious around new foods, as are, I would assume, most wild animals. But in this case, the rat wandered over and just began scarfing down the brightly colored cereal. The graduate student was inspired to try putting the rats on a diet of quote-unquote palatable supermarket food. Not only Fruit Loops, but foods like Doritos, pork rinds, and wedding cake. Today, researchers call this the cafeteria diet.
Sure enough, on this diet, the rats gained weight at an unprecedented speed. All this despite the fact that the high-fat and cafeteria diets had similar nutritional profiles, including very similar fat-to-calorie percentages, around 45%. In both diets, rats were allowed to eat as much as they wanted. When you give a rat a high-fat diet, it eats the right amount and then stops eating and maintains a healthy weight.
Which is why they gain weight so slowly when you just throw fat on the rat chow.
Mm-hmm. But when you give the rat the cafeteria diet, it just keeps eating and quickly becomes overweight. Something is making them eat more. Palatable human food is the most effective way to cause a normal rat to spontaneously overeat and become obese, says neuroscientist Stefan Guyonet in The Hungry Brain. And its fattening effect cannot be attributed solely to its fat or sugar content.
Rodents eating diets that are only high in fat or only high in carbs don't gain nearly as much weight as rodents eating the cafeteria diet. This is scientifically, like, studied and proven. Like, you can read the journals and the links in the notes of this. And this isn't limited to lab rats. Raccoons and monkeys quickly grow fat on human food as well. We see a similar pattern of results in humans. With access to lots of calorie-dense, tasty foods, people reliably overeat and rapidly gain weight. But again, it's not just the contents. For some reason, eating more fat or sugar by itself isn't as fattening as the cafeteria diet. Why is palatable human food so much worse for your waistline than its fat and sugar alone would suggest?
Mystery number 7. Altitude. People who live at higher altitudes have lower rates of obesity. This is the case in the U.S. and also seems to be the case in other countries, for example, Spain and Tibet. When the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force service members are assigned to different geographic areas, they are at more risk for developing obesity in low-altitude areas than in high-altitude ones. Colorado is the highest-altitude U.S. state and also has the lowest incidence of obesity, and Colorado will be coming back up throughout the series.
If you look at a map of country-level obesity data... If you look at a map of county-level obesity data in the United States, the Rockies, the Sierras, and the Appalachians, as well as our Catskills, stand out quite clearly.
Mm-hmm. And in this map, you've got, a scale from, almost pale yellow to deep red, and the Mississippi River Basin is all deep red, and any areas with... like high mountain peaks such as Colorado, parts of Idaho, and...
Maine is actually obese. My bad.
Maine is a bit
Maine
obese.
Maine doesn't have a lot of mountains.
And there's a nice line right through the Appalachians and up to the Catskills.
Yeah, up in Massachusetts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think there's also... you can see the county line divider in between Nassau and Suffolk if you look at No.
I don't know.
Anyway, similarly, there's a condition called altitude anorexia, where individuals who move to a high-altitude location sometimes lose a lot of weight all at once.
That happened to me.
This effect also seems to apply to lab rats who are moved to labs at higher altitudes. I want to note that when I moved from up here to down in Pittsburgh, I did gain a little bit of weight, and now I'm struggling to maintain that weight.
That's a good point.
In addition, there is some evidence for a similar relationship between altitude and the rate of diabetes, with people living at a higher elevation having lower rates of diabetes than those living near sea level, even when statistically adjusting for variables like age, BMI, and physical activity. Now, my guess for this was that it had something to do with you have to do more work to get the same amount of oxygen into your blood from the air, because higher altitudes, thinner air. We're about to get into why that's not the case. We know that oxygen and carbon dioxide vary with elevation, so you might expect that this is attributable to these differences. But the evidence is pretty thin. Combined with a low-calorie diet, exercise in a low-oxygen environment does seem to reduce weight more than exercise in a normal atmospheric conditions, but not by much. Submarines have CO2 levels about 10 times higher than usual, but a U.S. Navy study didn't find evidence of consistent weight gain. The atmosphere itself can't explain this. I want to mention also that studies on enclosed spaces like high schools show markedly increased by like a few times levels of ambient CO2, which also leads to poor thinking, poor memory, sleepiness, etc., which might explain the behavior of students.
So the air composition on its own can't explain it.
Can't explain obesity.
We will get to why that is in our next episode. For now, let's move on to mystery number 8. Diets don't work. There is a lot of disagreement about which diet is best for weight loss. People spend a lot of time arguing over how to diet. Some people do lose weight on diets. Some of them even lose a lot of weight. But the research best finds that diets just don't work very well in general. And no one diet seems better than the other. For example, a 2013 review of 4 meta-analyses said,
numerous randomized trials comparing diets differing in macronutrient compositions, like low-carb, low-fat, Mediterranean, etc., have demonstrated differences in weight loss and metabolic risk factors that are small, i.e. a mean difference of less than 1 kilogram, and inconsistent. Most diets lead to weight loss of around 5 to 20 pounds, with minimal differences between them. Now, 20 pounds isn't nothing, but it's also not much compared to the overall size of the obesity epidemic. And even if someone does lose weight, in general, they will gain most of it back within a year of going off... Oh, within a year. Not within a year of going off the diet, just within a year. Like, if you stay on that diet for a long enough time, your weight will just come back to where it was.
As someone who has been, you know, more than 100 pounds over what they wanted to weigh, that, 20 pounds might be nice, but it's not going to fix the problem, and it's not going to make me feel a whole lot better in general. And I might not feel it's worth it. So let's go on to...
Part 2.
Current theories of obesity are inadequate. None of them hold up to closer scrutiny. None can explain the mysteries mentioned in Part 1. But these mysteries are real, puzzling data about the obesity epidemic.
You're probably familiar with several theories of the obesity epidemic, but there is strong evidence against all of them, and we'll go through them one by one. So let's start with calories in, calories out. Pretty simple, you know? How much you eat depends, or has a big effect on how much you gain, etc., etc. And if you don't expend all of the calories that you eat in a day, then whatever's left over gets stored as fat. That's the assumption, anyway.
This perspective assumes that your body stores every extra calorie you eat as body fat, and that it doesn't have any tools for using more or less energy as the need arises. But this isn't the case. Your body has the ability to regulate these things, like its temperature, and it has tools, or like its temperature, it has tools to regulate body fatness.
When we look closely, it turns out that calories in, calories out really doesn't match the actual facts of consumption and weight gain. This model seems to exist mostly to make lean people feel smug, writes Stephen Goyer, since it attributes their leanness entirely to wise voluntary decisions and a strong character. I think at this point, few people in the research world believe in the calories in, calories out model. End quote. It's total moralization, in other words.
Exactly. Now, that doesn't mean that calories don't matter at all. Of course, people who are on a starvation diet of 400 calories a day will lose weight. And as we'll see in this section, people who eat hundreds of calories more than they need will usually gain weight. The problem is that this ignores how the body accounts for the calories coming in and going out. If you don't eat enough, your body finds ways to burn fewer calories. If you eat too much, your body doesn't store all the excess as fat and compensates by making you less hungry later on. Calories are involved in the math, but it's not so simple as weight gain equals calories in minus calories out.
And there's a whole other interlude on this whole thing for anyone who's a little skeptical. There's so much more written on this to turn your view if you'd like to engage with it.
It's pretty interesting.
I also want to point out that considering the lack of benefit in starving yourself, the massive risks that come with starving yourself simply do not make it worth it.
Mm.
Do not starve yourself.
Yeah.
Do not starve yourself. Do not starve your kids. Do not restrict your calories to the point where it affects your ability to think or do things. It is not good for you, and it won't even lead you to lose the weight that you want to lose. Okay, let's move on to the next heading. It's called common sense. Oh boy, I hate common sense. If it's so common.
Yeah. If it's so common, why doesn't everybody have it? If we want
it's
to present
moralizing hint.
Yeah. Everyone knows that diet and exercise are the solution to obesity, quote-unquote knows. Despite this, rates of obesity continue to increase, even with all the medical advice and pointing to diet and lifestyle interventions, and a $200 billion global industry devoted to helping people implement these interventions. It's not that no one is listening. People are exercising more today than they were 10 or even 20 years ago. Contrary to stereotypes, more than 50% of Americans meet the health and human safety guidelines for aerobic exercise, but obesity is still on the rise.
It's true that people eat more calories today than they did in the 60s and 70s, but the difference is quite small. Sources have a surprisingly hard time agreeing on just how much more we eat than our grandparents did, but all of them agree that it's really not much.
And there are some specific
you can read
calorie amounts.
If you want. I'm just going to move on now. If we go back further, the story becomes even more interesting. Based on estimates from nutrient availability data, Americans actually ate more calories in 1909 than they did in the 1960s.
Finally, there are many medical conditions that cause obesity. This actually does come to be relevant in some of the ensuing articles. For example, Prader-Willi syndrome, a genetic disorder characterized by intense hunger and resulting obesity. Hypothyroidism, an endocrine disorder where people experience loss of appetite and yet still gain 5 to 10 pounds. And lesions to the hypothalamus, which often lead to intense weight gain, sometimes accompanied by great hunger, but many times not.
Moving on to more scientific evidence, in addition to these common sense objections, decades of research suggests that diet and exercise are not to blame for rising rates of obesity. Studies of controlled overfeeding, you take a group of people and you get them to eat way more than they normally would, reliably find two things. First, a person at a healthy weight has to eat huge amounts of calories to gain even a couple of pounds. Second, after the overfeeding stops, people go right back to the weight they were before the experiment.
The great granddaddy of these studies is the Vermont Prison Experiment, published in 1971. Researchers recruited inmates from the Vermont State Prison, that's questionable ethically, all at a healthy weight, and assigned some of them to eat enormous amounts of food every day for a little over 3 months. How big were these meals? The original paper doesn't say, but later reports state that some of the prisoners were eating 10,000 calories a day.
I can't even imagine eating 3,000.
Fast food.
Well, that's fair. Yeah, you're right. On this Olympian diet, the prisoners did gain considerable weight, on average 35.7 pounds. But following the overfeeding section of the study, the prisoners all rapidly lost weight without any additional effort, just went back to the prison diet, lost the weight. And after 10 weeks, all of them returned to within a couple pounds of their original weight. One prisoner actually ended up about 5 pounds lighter than before the experiment began.
Yeah, I might have a little bit less of an appetite after eating that much.
Inspired by this, in 1972, George Bray decided to conduct a similar experiment on himself, which is slightly more ethical than doing it to prisoners, in my opinion.
That's what he felt. Anyway, he switched to energy-dense foods, especially milkshakes and ice cream. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead too hard.
Well, that's okay. I mean, the rest of it was just that
he was trying to...
Sorry, let me finish that, actually, because there's an interesting point in that previous thing. He was interested in conducting overfeeding studies and reasoned that if he was going to inflict this on others, he should be willing to undergo the procedure himself. Bravo. First, he tried to double each of his meals, but he found that he wasn't able to gain any weight. He simply couldn't fit two sandwiches into his stomach at every sitting.
Yeah, that's...
So then he switched
that
to
makes sense.
Yeah, so he switched to energy-dense foods like milkshakes, etc. and got himself to about 10,000 calories a day. Soon he began to put on weight and gained about 22 pounds over 10 weeks. He decided this was enough and returned to his normal diet. 6 weeks later, he was back at his original weight without any particular effort. In both cases, you'll notice that even when eating truly stupendous amounts of food, it actually takes more time to gain weight than it does to lose it. Many similar studies have been conducted. All of them find basically the same thing. And there's a lot of links here that you can check out if you are interested.
We can compare these numbers to the... Go ahead.
Overfeeding in controlled environments does make people gain weight, but they don't gain enough weight to explain the obesity pandemic. If you eat 10,000 calories a day, you might be able to gain 20 or 30 pounds, but most Americans are not eating 10,000 calories per day.
That's for sure.
We can compare these numbers to the increase in average calories per day we reviewed earlier. Sure, consumption in the U.S. went from about 2,025 calories in 1970 to 2,481 in 2010 per day. It's a difference of only 456 calories. But consider that when researchers fed a group more than of 12 men 1,000 extra calories per day for 22 days, on average, the men gained about 5 pounds, but some of them actually lost weight instead.
That's funny.
And it's not like they're eating 1,000 extra calories of celery and carrots. In one study, the extra calories came from sherbet, fruit juice, margarine, corn oil, and cookies. And honestly, there's a lot more discussion of like why like particular macronutrients, specifically like fat or sugar, like aren't to blame in particular about this. Mm-hmm. This is basically just a discussion of that.
The fact that many of these are twin studies provides even more evidence against calories in, calories out. In groups of twins that are all overfed by the same amount, there's a substantial variation between the different participants in general. Some people gain a lot, others gain almost none. But each person gains or loses about the same amount of weight as their twin. In some cases, these correlations can be highly substantial. This strongly suggests that genetics plays a large role. Genetics plays a large role in determining how the body responds to overfeeding.
The story with exercise is the same as with overeating. It makes a difference, but not much, and certainly not enough to explain the epidemic. One randomized control trial assigned overweight men and women to different amounts of exercise. More exercise did lead to more body fat loss, but even in the group exercising the most, equivalent to 20 miles of jogging a week for 8 months, people only lost about 7 pounds. You might think that hunter-gatherers have more an active lifestyle than we do, but that isn't always true. The Katavans we were talking about earlier, examined in 1990 by Stefan Lindeberg, were only slightly more active than Westerners, had more food than they know what to do with, and yet were never obese. Quote, many Westerners have a level of physical activity that is well within the range of the Katava population, end quote. Another quote, hence physical activity does not seem to explain most of the differences in disease pattern between Katava and the Western world.
That was what Stefan Lindeberg found whenever he studied these people. A recent meta-analysis of 36 studies compared the effects of interval training exercise with more traditional moderate intensity continuous training. The authors call interval training the magic bullet for fat loss. This is literally the title, and trumpet that it provides a 28.5% greater reductions in total absolute mass than moderate exercise.
But what they don't tell you is that this is a difference in loss between a loss of 8 pounds and about 4 pounds, or sorry, 3 pounds and 4 pounds for an exercise program running 12 weeks long. Needless to say, this difference isn't very impressive. Other meta-analyses find similar results.
So maybe calories themselves aren't the villain here. Maybe it's not that we're eating more than we used to. Maybe it's that we're eating differently. Maybe one particular macronutrient or source is to blame. Dietary fat seems like a possible culprit. After all, fat makes you fat, right? To begin with, fat consumption has actually fallen over the past few decades while obesity has skyrocketed. Plenty of cultures eat extremely high-fat diets and remain very lean indeed. You'll remember the Maasai diet is around 3,000 calories a day, and 66% of that is from fat. But the Maasai don't suffer from obesity. In fact, the Kalahari Bushmen apparently love fat and wax poetic about it.
They write disgusting poems.
I read that poem. It was really funny.
I just can't handle it. I'm just like, I can't eat that much fat. I don't understand.
Clinical results agree. Dietary fat doesn't have much of an impact on long-term weight.
Sorry, Bushman.
This is a little difficult to square with animal studies that find that a high-fat diet reliably leads to obesity in monkeys, dogs, pigs, hamsters, squirrels, rats, and mice.
It could just be that humans are not monkeys, dogs, pigs, hamsters, squirrels, rats, or mice, and that while dietary fat has an adverse effect on those species, it doesn't do much to us. Some of the hamster studies, for example, induced obesity simply by giving the hamsters extra sunflower seeds, a phenomenon not observed in humans. Pigs in particular will become obese even on low-fat diets when given the opportunity.
Okay. So maybe fat doesn't make you fat. What about carbs? All this bread can't be good for us.
That theory is dead on the starting line, though, because as obesity has gone up, consumption of carbs has gone down. We have a graph that we can't show you because we don't have slides.
But it shows going up, carb consumption going up until about 2000 and then going down while obesity continues to rise.
And, what about sugar? We have another chart on sugar and obesity, and it looks just about the same as the carbs one. We're eating less sugar today, and obesity continues to rise at the same rate.
So, no particular macronutrient could do it. How about diet in general? Over the past 40 years, there hasn't been much of a change in where people get their calories from. Americans get about 50% of their calories from carbohydrates, 30% from fat, and 20% from protein, and they have for years. At the same time, obesity continues to go up and up. Comparing these two trends, it's hard to imagine that macronutrients have anything to do with the obesity epidemic.
You'll recall the mystery 8 is that all diets work about equally well and not very much at all. It doesn't matter which diet you choose. You lose about the same number of pounds regardless, and you'll probably gain them back once you go off that diet.
Mm-hmm. Systematic comparison of weight loss diets with different comparisons of fat, protein, and carbohydrates finds that many different reduced calorie diets, people lose across many different reduced calorie diets, people lose about 13.2 pounds over 6 months, and in all cases, they began to gain the weight back after 12 months.
There are too many diets to review in full, of course, and we're almost out of time for today's show.
So we're going to skip the diets and go right on
But we see the same pattern in every diet that has been extensively studied.
Yes, that is a good point to make, but I really want to take a minute to talk about the lipostat, because that really is the linchpin in this thing, and it's really important to get to that. There's one theory of obesity that is almost entirely satisfying, based around the body's ability to regulate its adiposity. A house has a thermostat. The owner of the house sets the temperature to 72 degrees Fahrenheit, or if you're Owen, 68, because he likes it to be cold.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing. Like, my body wastes all this energy being extra hot for no reason.
Mm.
And that's just probably part of my lipostat. That's just how my metabolism works. So,
the thermostat detects the temperature of the house, and it takes action to drive the temperature to the set point of 72 degrees Fahrenheit. If the house is too cold, the thermostat will turn on the furnace. If the house is too warm, the air conditioning.
The human body has a lipostat, from the Greek lipos, meaning fat. Evolution and environmental factors set body fatness to some range, perhaps a BMI of around 23. The lipostat detects how much fat is stored and takes action to drive body fatness to that set point. If your body's too thin, the lipostat will drive you to eat more, exercise less, sleep more, and store more of what you eat as fat, so me. If your body is too fat, the lipostat will turn on the air conditioning. Just kidding. The lipostat will drive you to eat less, move and fidget more, and store less of the food that you eat as fat.
According to this theory, people become obese because something has gone wrong with the lipostat. If the owner of a house sets the thermostat to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, the house will quickly become too hot and will stay that way until the set point is changed or the furnace explodes.
Something similar is happening to obesity. The set point has been moved from a healthy and natural level of adiposity to an unusually high level. And all of the regulatory systems of the body are working in concert to push adiposity to that level and keep it there. The lipostat model is supported by more than 100 years of evidence. By the 1970s, Dr. Michael Cabanac and collaborators were publishing papers in the journal Nature on what they called the ponderostat.
Eventually, that got turned into the lipostat. Modern neuroscience and modern medical review articles, these are four separate links. Overwhelmingly support this homeostatic explanation. In animals and humans, brain damage to the implicated areas tends to lead to overeating and eventual obesity. These symptoms are well understood enough that by targeting certain neurons, you can cure or cause obesity in mice. While we don't approve of destroying neurons in human brains with hyperspecific chemical techniques, the few weight loss drugs approved by the FDA largely act on the brain.
Hopefully without destroying any neurons.
Yeah.
The lipostat explains why diet and exercise work a little, why they don't work well enough to reverse obesity, and why people who lose weight on diets generally end up gaining that weight right back. In a house where the thermostat has been set to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, there are a lot of things that we can do to lower the temperature. We can open all the doors and the windows, we can open the ice box, we can order mountains of dry ice off of the internet. All of these things will lower the temperature of the house a little, but even with these measures, the house will still be hotter than the healthy temperature of 72 Fahrenheit. The furnace will work double time to push the temperature back up to 120 if it's not redlining already, and as soon as you relax any of your heat dissipation measures, the temperature will go right back to where it was before. We can also go down to the basement and hit the furnace with crowbars until it doesn't work very well anymore. This is a pretty extreme solution, and also, incidentally, why gastric bypass surgery works so well.
So, that is... I think all that we have time for today, that's
sadly,
for sure.
Sadly, it is.
Next time, we will try to get into some of the potential causes for the obesity epidemic. There are several articles on that, and we will prepare information on that. And also conclusions and what you and not just what you as an individual can do, but what we as a society can collectively work together to like help each other to become less fat. Because if your individual actions when you are you don't if your individual actions can only take the sort of actions like, you know, turning on the air conditioning while the furnace is going, then you're just going to waste a bunch of energy. And, you know,
to stretch the metaphor a little bit, if society has set the furnace to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, there's only so much you can do mm-hmm. without changing society to address the fact that your house is too hot.
Yeah. So, you can find more about this at slimemoldtimemold.com. And
I highly encourage you to satiate your curiosity and spoil the ending for yourself. There's so much to read here.
It's fun.
We'll be back talking about this in 2 weeks, but until then, definitely, like, read as much as you want. It is great.
And you can listen back again if you didn't feel like you caught everything, but also don't feel, maybe you're not very good at reading and don't feel up to it or whatever. You can always listen back to our radio episodes again, especially if you missed something. At thetruthissoboring.org. I will not have that up until next Tuesday, unfortunately, because I forgot to start the recording at home before we left.
I am concerned. I do not believe we have enough time for our 7-minute outro today.
It's not 7 minutes. It's like four. It's like 3.5 minutes. It's that thing where the file gets messed up.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. Okay, why don't you intro it then?
The Truth is So
Thank
Boring.
You.
My name is Scott, and this is Owen, and we're going to listen to... are we going to listen to the David Graeber clip?
Yeah, we are. I just got a little groove in the background.
Okay. Well, this is David Graeber. We can. The only way to save the planet is to stop working.
Our society is addicted to work. If there's anything left and right both seem to agree on, is that jobs are good. Everyone should have a job. Work is our badge of moral citizenship. We seem to have convinced ourselves as a society that anyone who isn't working harder than they would like to be working at something they don't enjoy is a bad, unworthy person. As a result, work comes to absorb ever greater proportions of our energy and time. Much of this work is entirely pointless. Whole industries, think telemarketers, corporate law, private equity, whole lines of work, middle management, brand strategists, high-level hospital or school administrators, editors of in-house corporate magazines, exist primarily to convince us there is some reason for their existence. Useless work crowds out useful. Think of teachers and administrators overwhelmed with paperwork. It's also almost invariably better compensated. As we've seen in lockdown, the more obviously your work benefits other people, the less they pay you. The system makes no sense. It's also destroying the planet. If we don't break ourselves of this addiction quickly, we will leave our children and grandchildren to face catastrophes on a scale which will make the current pandemic seem trivial. If this isn't obvious, the main reason is we're constantly encouraged to look at social problems as if they were questions of personal morality. All this work, all the carbon we're pouring into the atmosphere, must somehow be the result of our consumerism. Therefore, to stop eating meat or dream of flying off to beach vacations. But this is just wrong. It's not our pleasures that are destroying the world. It's our puritanism, our feeling that we have to suffer in order to deserve those pleasures. If we want to save the world, we're going to have to stop working. 70% of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide come from infrastructure, energy, transport, construction. Most of the rest is produced by industry. Meanwhile, 37% of British workers feel if their jobs are entirely unnecessary. If they were to vanish tomorrow, the world would not be any worse off. Simply do the maths. If those workers are right, we could massively reduce climate change just by eliminating bullshit jobs. So that's proposal one. Proposal two, construction. An enormous amount of building today is purely speculative. All over the world, governments collude with the financial sector to create glittering towers that are never occupied. Empty office buildings, airports that are never used. Stop doing this. No one will miss them. Proposal 3. Planned obsolescence. One of the main reasons we have such high levels of industrial production is that we design everything to break or to become outmoded and useless in a few years' time. If you build an iPhone to break in 3 years, you can sell 5 times as many than if you make it to last 15. But you also use 5 times the resources and create 5 times the pollution. Manufacturers are perfectly capable of making phones or stockings or light bulbs that wouldn't break. In fact, they actually do. They're called military grade. Force them to make military grade products for everyone. We could cut down greenhouse gas production massively and improve our quality of life. These three are just for starters. If you think about it, they're really just common sense. Why destroy the world if you don't have to? If addressing them seems unrealistic, we might do well to think hard about what those realities are that seem to be forcing us, as a society, to behave in ways that are literally mad.
WIOX is supported by the following underwriters.